to the Gentleman Ultra podcast. Today, I'm thrilled to be joined by Radio Royalty, an author, a podcast host extraordinaire, host of the BBC's Up All Night. Hopefully, I've got that right. And you also may know him from the Football Rambles on the Continent and the fantastic Brazilian Shirt Name podcast. And of course, the institution that is the BBC World Football Phone-In, member of the Order of the British Empire. I had to write that down. Dotton Adebayo, welcome to the show.
I wasn't expecting you to bring in the British Empire so soon in this conversation, but hey, I've got to live with that as well.
I take it. Did you get anything for that? They give you a sash.
They
a
give
robe,
you a medal. They a do sword. Give you a medal. No, not a sword, not anymore. And but they do give you a medal, a little nice medal. And I never use it as part of my title, but I know that whenever people do research on me on Wikipedia or whatever, they're really impressed by it. And I know I'm going to speak to a group of kids in a couple of weeks' time, and no doubt their teacher has said to them, oh, he's got an MBE as well, whatever that means outside. No, when I was a kid, it would have really impressed me. And, I haven't got a problem.
Bring the medal. Is that what the teachers say?
Well, no, she hasn't said that yet. I don't think they would dare say that to my face. I've got to find it, first of all, as well. I'm sure my wife has kept it, somewhere safe for me, because I wouldn't have a clue right now where it was. Wow. I have an inkling it might be in the next room that I'm sitting, the next room to where I'm sitting at the moment, but I wouldn't be able to find it just off the drop of a hat, yeah.
Oh, well, it's well deserved. So for those that don't know you, Dotton, yeah, give us a brief backstory, if you can, how you came to where you are. I know there's several stops and continents on the way, but...
Well, let's start continentally then. Born in Africa, 1959, came to Britain September the 19th, 1965, grew up initially in North London, moved to South London, moved back to North London. Formative sort of growing up years, I suppose, we're in the borough of Haringey, where Tottenham is. And, I immediately was told to follow Tottenham and not go to the dark side, as the people across the road were going. And then I had, went through my secondary school, got into a lot of trouble, I've got to be honest, unnecessarily, but didn't know any better, all sorts of family issues were, affecting a young boy at that time, and got thrown out of school for burning down the chemistry lab. And at the same time, I discovered rock and roll, discovered James Dean, and more importantly, discovered the word rebel. And that seemed to suit me very nicely. And I went on being a rebel for, I don't know why or how, but just for most of my, the rest of my growing up years. Finally, fell back in line, went back to university. Oh, I went overseas to start my sort of university, higher education, went to Stockholm in Sweden, where I got a scholarship, and played around too much. My mother died in the middle of that, and you lose track of what you're supposed to be doing. Came back to Britain and carried on at university. So eventually, did what I was supposed to do, studied philosophy. I'd started journalism in Sweden, just fanzines, as we were doing in those days, late 70s, punky sort of fanzines. I learned the language pretty quickly, so I was able to write in Swedish very quickly, and then continued the journalism there. Got a few jobs working on the radio and magazines then, and a few newspaper articles. Came back to Britain with lots and lots of cuttings. Started writing in the music press, which I'd done most of the time in Sweden. Eventually, transferred over to the news press, tabloid newspapers in Britain mostly. Then eventually started a publishing company called The Express in 1992, when somebody gave me a manuscript. First book went absolutely ballistic. I mean, for people who didn't know anything about publishing books, it was amazing. This book, Yardi, just took off, and we seemed to do everything right. Eventually got made into a film 25 years later by Idris Elba, but spent most of the 90s, between 92 and 98, really, publishing books, first-time authors, mostly Black interest books, mostly, not exclusively, though. Then married the Queen of Lovers Rock in, well, first of all, got together with the Queen of Lovers Rock. It was an unfinished sort of chapter in my life that was then concluded, and we got together and became a father in 1998 for the first time. We got married a couple of years later after our second child had been born. And I am Mr. Carol Thompson ever since then. Eventually, the BBC saw the light and realized that they needed to give me a few programs. And I've been, it used to be called Up All Night, but funny enough, it's just called Dotton Adebayo now. You know, this new thing in the broadcasting media. You don't call a program by some abstract name, you call it by the name of the presenter. So I'm overnight, basically, same hours, 1 o'clock to 5 o'clock in the morning, UK time. And that's pretty much where I am till today. I don't think anything else has happened. You mentioned all the podcasts and everything else, yeah.
And that's it. That's all we've got time for, is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, a potpourri of events, yeah.
So you mentioned you moved across to Sweden, you came back to England, you know, there's so much in between there.
Oh yeah, I forgot my time in America where I became best friends with Dr. Dre in Los Angeles when I lived there. And I forgot my time running around with Tennessee Williams, the great playwright, here in Britain in 1977 before I went to Sweden in a play where, funnily enough, the man who would later become a James Bond. Oh, I forgot to mention I was in a James Bond film, Diamonds Are Forever, only as an extra, but nevertheless.
You've got to mention that on every podcast that you're
yeah,
on.
Well, exactly. So Pierce Brosnan was in that play where, you know, I got to know Tennessee Williams. No, generally, probably the greatest highlight of my life I've discovered ought to be that I ran around with Tennessee Williams for about 6 months in London when I was 17. That was amazing. I didn't realise how amazing it would be at the time. Mm. You don't realise. You say, oh, that's the bloke who wrote Streetcar Named Desire, Glass Menagerie. But years later, I got to realize, no. Forget the being in Diamonds Are Forever or whatever you did. Actually, knowing Tennessee Williams for that long was
pretty cool. Time you can't have back, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So you were working in the press and in the media, Fleet Street, I guess, the early 90s. Yes, do you remember much of you talked about this on the Brazilian Shirt Name podcast about the Paul Gascoigne, the hype and the time before he moved to Italy?
It was funny. I do remember that. I mean, he was the greatest thing since sliced bread for us, because he was not just a footballer, but he was a footballer who was a personality, a national personality. And it was one of those moments that, you know, George Best was the initial sort of football superstar, but because he played for Northern Ireland, he perhaps didn't have the same impact on the national psyche as Paul Gascoigne would a generation or so later. But David Beckham has been in that position, and Wayne Rooney too, where the whole of Britain is hanging on your shoulders, dependent upon you to go and win the flipping World Cup or whatever it is you're going to play in. And Paul Gascoigne preceded David Beckham, preceded Wayne Rooney, was on his own. You're actually on your own when you're in that position. You feel, in retrospect, I feel really sorry for those footballers who are put in that, because it must be a huge amount of pressure. You know, the nation hangs on your every kick. And, you know, if you suddenly are injured, the whole nation, oh, no. You know, it's kind of like you feel like you let the whole nation down as a result of that. I do remember it very, very well. And Paul Gascoigne was probably the best footballer of his generation in England, certainly at that time. Mm. And but he lended himself to the press, partly because he was kind of quirky, like he was like a Northeasterner, but a proper Geordie kind of like, and it was a bit weird that, you know, I don't know what you expect from your footballers, but he played up to the stereotype of a Geordie lad, might we say, you know, and it worked for the papers.
Do you think
perhaps distracted him from his football?
Yeah. Do you think his move to Italy was to get away from all of that? Or in part?
Could have been. I mean, I don't know what was going on in his mind, but he had advisors at the time. That might have been part of it. Although, having said that, if he wanted to get away from the fame, as it were, he could have. He didn't have to play ball with the press. You know, he didn't have to act, you know, the fool to a certain extent. Mm. And I don't mean that disrespectfully to him, but, you know, if you take in the sort of like medieval form of the court jester, that's what he was. Mm. He could have stopped doing that, and the press would have eventually sort of like thought, oh, well, you know, he's not worth bothering about so much. So he didn't have to move to another country to do that, but it's, if he wanted to carry on with the fame, he should have stayed in England. It's a confusing one. I generally don't know what the answer to that is. Yeah. I do know that him moving to Italy gave Channel 4 Football, which Channel 4 was the only, the fourth of our TV stations, the only TV station that covered Italian football at that time. It was a huge revelation for us all as well about Italian football, because until then I grew up sort of knowing names like Luigi Riva, if you remember him, Gigi Riva. He was like, I mean, just from the World Cup, you knew foreign players from the World Cup, and his name seemed to resonate amongst all us schoolboys at the time growing up. And the late Paolo Rossi, as he is now, as well, was one of those names later time. But Luigi Riva was the very first Italian footballer, I think, that, you know, resonated with me as a young boy in Tottenham. But we didn't ever get to see the domestic football in Italy until Channel 4 started showing it. And it used to be on a Sunday, I mean, live football. And it was a bit weird in any case, because I don't think we were, Sunday football was that much of a thing in England at the time. You played football at 3 p.m. on a Saturday generally. And just seeing the Italian football, there was a lot of criticism at the beginning about Italian football being very defensive and everything like that. But for me, it was really fascinating to see the whole crowd experience, you know, from a distance, but nevertheless, it did seem harder to get a goal in Italy, because it was like 1-0s and 0-0 draws and things like that. But the football was just of a different level. We knew, I think, looking at that English footballers looked like, you know, again, not disrespectfully, but workhorses in comparison to the stallions of Italian football.
Was it, I can't remember if this is true or not, but was it the first televised live game, I think, the Italian game into England, beamed into the lounge rooms, of course. So I think it was a 4-4 draw. That's, I think, from memory. That. I could be wrong, but yeah, it goes against everything that people assume would be Italian football. You know, the 1-0 or the 0-0 and the defensive performances. Yeah. So what's your perception, or what's your perception or your idea of current day Italian football? Like, you've got Tammy Abraham in Roma, and there's Tomori at AC Milan, and Miles Maitland at Roma as well, and a few others there. Do you hear much about their exploits or what's going on in the press or in the media?
Oh, I follow it much closer now, because for the last 2 years I've been doing On the Continent, which is Football Rambles, sort of a continental football podcast. And so I know everything about, you know, Tammy Abraham's success with Roma. It came on firing, all guns blazing, went through a little bit of a dip, but seems to be back on form now. Came there at the same time, of course, as Jose Mourinho. So I follow that as a follower of European football generally, but you don't see it on the TV here anymore, which is a bit of a shame, or at least not on terrestrial TV, which is a bit of a shame. I think I follow the current, you know, fortunes of the battle of the Milans, as it were, at the top of the league at the moment. And clearly Inter are going to take it, is my prediction. I know it's on a knife edge, but AC Milan, which was probably my first love in Italian football. Not because of George Weah, although George Weah was playing at that time, and I do remember that amazing goal from his own half, taking it all the way, dribbling through everybody on the left wing to score the goal. Not so much because of that. I'll tell you why AC Milan was my favorite team. First of all, their shirts are amazing for us. We've never seen black and red stripes, you know, over in the UK. We don't have that at all, let alone black and blue stripes. But I remember, and I can't remember which player this was.
So but Italia 90 had a big influence on.
I was going to say.
Football fans in England, is that right?
Yeah, huge. I mean, we saw every game. And I think it might have been in the world. It could have been Italian 90, actually. It must have been, I guess. Mm. But anyway, I just remember the Italian footballer I'm talking of, the striker, they played an African team. And I don't remember for the life of me which African team it was. But afterwards, he showed a real sort of, you know, warmth and friendship to the team that they just beaten, and went around and shook the hands of the players for the opposite team. I just, it stuck with me that it was a very sort of beautiful moment. And then I saw him playing for AC Milan and I thought, yeah. And I'm ashamed that I don't remember his name. But
just for a disclaimer, we've got to say it's 5:30 in the morning there. You've just come off a 5-hour shift or thereabouts. So
even if it was, I've got to be honest, even if it was 9:30 or, you know, midday, I still wouldn't remember his name off the top of my head.
I don't want to guess and assume who it is. So that's why I'm not going to take any wild.
I was a much younger man. And the disclaimer should be, you know, for everybody listening, I'm now 62 years old and your brain starts going. Your brain starts going at this age, mate, for whatever reason. I've tried to keep it in check. Sometimes, you know, so I'd have to do some research to get to the bottom of that. But
You've got another link there because you've got Ibrahimovic there, who, of course, is a Swedish legend.
We call him Zlatan. So. Yeah, he's post my time in Sweden, but I do follow Swedish football. I'm a Hammarby supporter for my sins. And he has bought up Hammarby. You know that he's an investor in Hammarby now. We were hoping he'd come after he's finished, you know, playing around in your leagues. He'd come and do a sort of his retirement Hammarby. I don't think that's going to happen, but nevertheless. In fact, Italy's been good hunting grounds for Swedish football ever since, I suppose, Sven-Göran Eriksson went to manage over there. I couldn't understand. It was Sampdoria, I think, he managed. Mm-hmm. Couldn't understand what he achieved there, to be honest. But they seemed to like him. So for whatever, you know, I don't understand, it must be the style of play or whatever it was. But that gig probably got him the England job subsequently. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I can't say that the impact of Sven-Göran Eriksson on the England team has been one that has, you know, has permeates through the football today, the national football today. I don't think so.
Sampdoria, and then he also managed Lazio, and that's who he was quite successful with in Rome. Yeah, and then.
Oh, okay.
I think years after that, that was when he came across to England, of course.
Yeah.
So you mentioned it there about how you saw the Italian player talking to the opposition, and that connection between, you know, two strangers from two different continents.
Exactly.
Never met each other. And we touched on this just before we pressed record, but that unique ability of football to bring people together and make everyone feel like they're a part of a community. You know, with your work on the World Football Phone-In, for those that don't know, you know, anyone from around the world can call in. You put your question to a panel of experts. You've seen that firsthand, that power.
It's beautiful.
How massive is it? Like, how big is it for those that don't understand?
Well, to speak to you all the way in Australia, and you follow, you know, English football, you follow Italian football, what other conversation could ever bring us together in this way? Sure, if we all read the same books and everything like that, but it's not the same. There isn't a visceral feeling. It's books tend to intellectualize things. If we all watched movies and discussed them, then that would be great. But we don't watch movies that are, for example, non-English speaking movies. We don't watch them. So I couldn't have a conversation with you about Italian films, although they're brilliant. Don't get me wrong. The ones that I see are absolutely brilliant. And I do know a little bit about the history of Italian directors, certainly. But generally, we don't see them. And it's not a weekly event either. And it doesn't necessarily, watching Italian films doesn't open me up to a world, a global world. It will open me up to an insight into Italian culture and Italian romance, or, you know, Italian, the Italian language or whatever it is. Only in football does, and of late, it brings a whole world in, but it's been doing that for some time, for about half a century, let's be fair. But only through Italian football could I see a footballer like Mario Balotelli and then suddenly think, oh, there are black people in Italy. Now, remember, before Balotelli, but I only thought about black, I'd seen some black players in Italy, like I mentioned George Weah and so on, but they were from overseas. They weren't, you know, Italians. They were not Italians. George Weah very much is the president of Liberia and probably was the president of Liberia even when he was kicking the football upside, at least in people's minds. He was the most famous Liberian at the time. It certainly wasn't Ellen Sirleaf, who was actually the president. But I think it's Ellen Sirleaf, President Sirleaf, anyway. When Mario Balotelli opened his mouth, I was expecting him to be a Ghanaian guy with English as his first language, you know, because I didn't have a sort of a concept that there were black Italians. Like, I would have a concept that they're black British people, you know. I wouldn't think twice, a black person from Britain, yeah, he's going to speak Cockney or whatever it is. Up until then, most of the press I'd heard about Africans living in Italy who weren't sort of footballers or sports people or otherwise was about prostitution. And that wasn't a good look. That wasn't a way that I wanted to have an insight into Italy. And when Balotelli opened his mouth, that first time I heard him open, I'd heard about Balotelli quite a lot because he had had sort of problems in AC Milan where he was at. And also remember, you know, black British players from over here like Luther Blissett going over to Italy and being part of this Q phenomenon. I don't know if you know about these, this anarchist group called Q. I've got their book, by the way. They've got a book, I've got it, you know, next door from where I'm sitting now on the bookshelf. This amazing book called Q. It's a brilliant book, actually. These anarchists put out, and the author is supposedly Luther Blissett.
Luther Blissett, is that right?
You know, they took his name out of tribute, in tribute to
somebody. He knows nothing about it.
Well, he does, actually, because I've spoken to him and mentioned it.
Yeah, he doesn't now, but he didn't write the book, is that right?
Yeah, he didn't write the book at all, but they used the name in tribute to the struggles he had, you know, fighting the good fight of anti-racism in Italy, pretty much on his own at that time. And so when I, going back to Balotelli, I'd heard about him and some of the problems he had race-wise when he was playing at AC Milan. So I was waiting for him. I couldn't wait for him. But like I said, I expected him to be somebody who spoke English as his first language, not Italian. But when I was like, saw him, he was like, yes, well, you know, I was like, what? There are black people in Italy. I went to Venice with my daughters. And I remember at the airport, I thought, you know, let's take you can take one of these sort of boats from the airport to, you know, the old Venice, as it were. And I thought, let's go. And the guy that was like organizing the boat trip, he was a black guy and he's speaking Italian. For me, you know, how else but through the prism of football would I have come to that realization that there is a black Italian community, young people growing up in Italy speaking Italian as their first language. You know, when we come from Britain or, you know, France or Holland, even Belgium, and obviously Portugal, slightly different thing there, you think, well, it's not unusual to have the multiracial communities and the second generation of those communities being more of the host country than they are than their parents, or their countries of their parents' origin. We take it for granted, but in Italy, and I traveled a lot in Italy when I hitchhiked right through Europe when I was a teenager. And so I traveled quite a lot in Italy, and I don't remember seeing young black Italians, you know, at all. I never ever experienced racism. I'm not saying that there wasn't that, but I never really experienced racism traveling through Italy. I experienced more traveling through Greece, funny enough, but not through Italy so much. And And I love Italy as a country. I think it's a wonderful, beautiful, historic country and everything like that. But I was always seen as a tourist there. You know, I was always seen and regarded as a tourist. Everybody said, oh, so where are you from? So where are you from? You know, and now I feel it'll probably be less like that than it was. I'm not saying Italy is suddenly, all of Italy is suddenly multicultural. I'm not saying that at all. But I'm saying through the prism of football, I learned that Italy now has a generation of young Black people who are Italian first.
Yeah, it's a problem, you know, the racism problem in Italy, it still sadly still exists. And try as they might, some people just can't accept that fact, you know, that they are a part of the community, they are a part of the football landscape and environment, whether it's a Black, white or red skinned player, it doesn't matter. At the end of the day, Balotelli is Italian, it's still such a huge, you know, touchy sensitive issue for a lot of people over there.
But it will, when you see more Balotellis coming through, and when you see more Black players representing Italy, when you see others that achieve it, and that's what happened in Britain, then the racists find it very difficult. I thought about this quite a lot. You know, when I grew up, there was a lot of racism in Britain. And, you know, there really was only one or two or three Black footballers, and they all played for West Ham. And West Ham was traditionally one of those areas where you would think there was a lot of racism because, you know, working class area, there's all these tensions due to propaganda that, you know, these Black people are taking all your jobs and all your homes and, yeah, blah, blah, blah. And whereas what I remember about the East End when I was growing up was, you know, like, we were all working class together, mate. We were living side by side, you know. I grew up in Tottenham's not far, you know, it's like the East End of North London. And it was one moment I remember my stepmother, when my younger brothers went to a nursery school and they had like a Christmas party. My stepmother, you know, very Nigerian woman, grew up in Nigeria, lived in Nigeria until she was about, you know, in her mid-20s, maybe late 20s, and came to Britain at that point. She would have still been in her early 20s when she came to Britain, and but she was still very Nigerian, ate Nigerian food every single day, you know, scrubbed up really well to go and work in government ministries and stuff like that. She could speak English as well as anybody else, with or without an accent. And one day she must have had a little bit to drink, but it was a Christmas party, and I went with her there, and she was like doing the old knees up Mother Brown sort of thing. Oh, the okie cokie. And it was for me, that was when I realized it's not just me and my brothers that are English, but, you know, my parents, you just absorb this thing, whether you like it or not. You know? And we were very middle class in Nigeria, so to sort of like be very working class in England was quite something. But that's what I remember, what the communities were like. And then eventually more and more footballers came, because football was, or is, the, like some people say, the church of the working classes or whatever, until the football prices started going up. And you know, you look at that and you think, hang on, it was football. Partly, not exclusively, but football played a huge part in making the streets of Britain tolerable. Not initially, you know, there was a battle for those streets through football and through punk music. I remember the very earliest punk gigs. Imagine me being a Black guy into punk when all the other Black guys were into reggae or soul or whatever. The earliest punk gigs, the fascist, I don't even think they're political, but they were young boys who were affiliated to the racist parties, as it were. I wouldn't call them parties, but racist organizations and stuff. They'd go to these punk concerts and start saying Sieg Heil, Sieg Heil, Sieg Heil, or whatever at the back, and you're like, shit, what am I doing here, you know? And then there'd be punk
groups for the music.
Yeah, but there'd be punk groups like The Clash singing "White Riot, I want a riot, white riot, a riot of my own. Black man's got a lot of problems, but he knows how to throw a brick." And you'd be analysing, are they, is that positive? Is that negative? What are they trying to say? You just didn't know at the beginning. And it was like, there was a moment going to places like the 100 Club in Oxford Street where you're going to the gig and you think, God, who's racist here and who's not? I don't know. The Stranglers, they had a song called "Feel Like a Wog," and I was like, in the concept of "Feel Like a Wog," and I'm like, what the fuck is this? What am I doing here? You know, it wasn't quite clear where they were politically.
And well, I know what that means in Australia, that the slang term for a wog.
Well, it means exactly the same in the UK as well,
because that's even here. Like, it's, I grew up in a, like, so my, both of my parents were born in Italy, came to Australia. When that, you know, obviously they were, my father was a teenager. My mum was, well, she was 11, 12. My grandma came over, couldn't speak the language, didn't have a job, didn't have a lot of money. My grandfather had come a couple of years earlier to work, you know, and get the savings up. But football had a way of bringing all those multicultural communities together, you know, and there was Italian clubs and Croatian clubs and whatever it else may be, Maltese football clubs and Jewish football clubs. And that was like a safe place for them all. That was a safe space for them to go on the weekend and essentially feel like they're back at home, you know, hanging out together, watch football, talk, and what more could you want?
Talk, very important, because what did we have to talk about? You can talk about how miserable life is for immigrants in your country, or you can talk through the prism of music is one way to talk. I just came back from 2 days ago from a day and a half ago from a music festival in Great Yarmouth, a seaside resort in England, and it was a festival started by one of the guys in The Specials, the two-tone group, Neville Staples and his wife. And actually, it's because it's like a old school ska festival, most of the people there are skinheads, and skinheads were notorious for being racist, but this was like a second wave of skinheads that didn't understand what skinheads were all about. Skinheads initially were the epitome of working class culture, and their musical soundtrack was Jamaican music, when Jamaican music was underground music, you know, whether it be ska or rock steady, blue beat as they used to call ska, or the early roots of reggae. So they used to dance, you know, there used to be a dance called the Skinhead Moon Stomp, and it was a dance to reggae music. They danced to reggae. And the first when I was about 7 years old, I used to go to school, and there used to be a park next to the school. I used to rush out of school as fast as I can to go and meet my skinhead friends, older kids, older teenagers. But, you know, they loved me and they took care of me and everything. That's my experience of skinheads. Now they're all in their 50s or 60s, maybe even some of them in their 70s and showing up at Great Yarmouth. There wasn't a single hint of any racism amongst them. And yet skinheads... what happens is, like, the extreme groups of people who want to, you know, feed disharmony into communities will try and appropriate these youth groups, or they did in those days successfully, and turn them into racists. And that's got nothing to do. I mean, how can you be a skinhead and your soundtrack is reggae music? How can you, I don't know how that can work. It can't work. So they had to sort of like come up with their own sort of like music. They called Oi at that time. And, you know, it was supposed to be something, basically it's rock and roll predicated on the blues, which at the end of the day is black music, whatever you want to call it. So they had a confusion around that. But usually, generally, the points of interest between immigrant groups was what music do you like, what food do you eat, which football team do you support? And that was it for us. That's how we probably communed around that. My best friends were Greek Cypriot. My best friend in life was Greek Cypriot. He's late now, but the Greek Cypriot, you know, lived in the Greek Cypriot community, went to their weddings and everything like that, simply because I went to school with Greek Cypriots and I met other Greek Cypriots and Turkish Cypriots because we went to the same clubs. You know, we were all immigrants together. So what music do you think they listened to as teenagers? They weren't listening to the music from Cyprus, you know, that wasn't the cool music. Just like we weren't listening to the music from Africa when we grew up, that wasn't the cool music. But the music from Jamaica or the music from Black America was very cool, and we went to those clubs together, black, white, and whatever. And later on, we went to football matches together. Not even later on, pretty much at the same time.
Yeah, and like we said about talking, like I still have memories of, you know, them talking in their language, still talking in Italian. That was a place where they could go and essentially feel at home and not feel as though, you know, I'm being looked at funny or being told to, you know, speak English, you're wob, you know, that to give it that phrase. But yeah, it was a comfortable, safe place for them.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you gave that. You used that phrase rather than me, because there were other, you know, not very pleasant phrases that people used about Italian people. But I don't remember any of us as teenagers. You know, one of my old school friends, Roberto Molinari, whose mum was Welsh, by the way, but his old man, I remember his old man very, very, very clearly. When at the age of 12, I wanted to try and get into broadcasting, his old man used to work as, you know, one of the sort of security guards at one of the BBC buildings. I went to the old BBC World Service building, which was at Bush House. And he saw me there and he said, you know, what are you doing here? And I said, well, I'm coming up to try and sort of see if they'll let me work. And he took me up to the person I was going to go and see and everything. He was very proud of me at the time. His father was late now. I've learned. But he called up the program just the other day because he didn't realize I was on the radio, you know, after all this time. And of course, you know, it's somebody that you were at school with and you never ever thought, it wasn't like it was Italian. You only know that from his name. But otherwise, you know, we were all Cockney. Mm. Now, come on now, give us a break. We were just like trying to make things work. I love Italy as much because I've read Romeo and Juliet as it is that I've gone to school with Italian people. I mean, look, you cannot knock Italy for the history of the Roman Empire, the evidence of it in Rome, but elsewhere, the evidence of the Renaissance in Italian philosophy still dominates the landscape outside of Italy, not to talk of music, etc. So what's there not to love about Italy? And I want to be a part of that as well. I don't want to stand outside. I want to embrace myself, engage in it. And it's one of the great fortunes of Italy to be this place and this culture and this history that everybody wants to immerse themselves in. Everybody who doesn't,
yeah,
who
right.
doesn't, you know, right. Which part of the world doesn't want a bit of Italy? Yeah, you go to parts of the world and they call it the Russian Venice, the South American Venice, you know, any city that's got water, they'll call it the something Venice in the world. What are they trying to align themselves with?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And at the end of the day, if you do travel over there and you don't immerse yourself in that experience, whether it's good or bad, or, you know, failing to speak the language properly or ordering the wrong food, or much like me, going to the going to the stadium on the wrong day and thinking, oh, that's right, the game's tomorrow night. That's all part of the fun of traveling.
And wearing your shorts as well. Wearing your shorts. Who but you didn't know that Italians have got a bit of style about them? Yeah. Wearing shorts. You can't do that in Italy.
That's right. Yeah. To be fair, though, Your Honour, I did have a buttoned-up shirt on, so, you know, with a collar.
I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, that's quite.
But do it with style. If it's Italy, you do it with style. Everybody knows that.
That's right. That was my mistake for going in winter, see?
Yeah, you see, you're thinking it was winter anyway.
Well, I'll wrap this up because we've got to go, obviously. But I just want to say personal thanks. So I've got a story that's on the Gentleman Ultra website, which talked about my anxiety and my depression. 2015, 2016, had some family issues and there was a separation. And I wasn't in a great space. A lot of it was me being surrounded by a dark cloud and a lot of overthinking. And the few things that kept me going, aside from my three beautiful children, who I love more than anything, was books, music, and listening to comedy and listening to podcasts. And every week I so look forward to the World Football phone-in, whether it was you singing, Tim and his dodgy accents. They took me out of that cloud and they lifted me up above it. And for those 2 or 3 hours every week, I forgot about everything. So that show means a lot to me and I'm eternally grateful for that, even though I never get the chance to tell you guys in person. Well, I am now, which is good. But through your voice and everyone else who's on the show, it's I hope that's something that you never take for granted, that you have the power to change someone's day and change someone's life. And you and the rest of your gang have done that for me. So I'm always appreciative. I always used to tell people the few things that saved my life, and Dotton and Tim Vickery were one of them. So I'm greatly appreciative that you've found the time to come on and talk today. And if I rewind back 6 years ago, never in my wildest dream would I ever had the opportunity to talk to you. So I'm really appreciative. Well, and hopefully I can do it again and we can talk more about Italy.
Yeah, absolutely. First of all, let me say it's an absolute privilege. I never take it for granted that I'm privileged to be able to talk to people on the radio. I also have had, you know, my difficult times and moments and been in depression. And, you know, you always have to remember that you're not alone. You're not alone. Happens to so many people. And sometimes, you know, when you are in your lowest moments, you know, not particularly you, not particularly me, but anybody, when you're in your lowest moments, look around you and think for a moment, maybe you're not the only one. And you've got to think about how other people get around it. It's important for you to say books, music, podcasts, or whatever it is was important. For me, in my darkest moment, it was, first of all, the support of friends was absolutely amazing. You know, if I start thinking about it too much now, I'll break down and cry because you didn't realize how much your friends are there to support you, let alone your family are there to support you.
Funny you say that, because I essentially isolated myself from my friends and family because of that perception that I had that they had of me. But I thought of me even telling you this morning and I broke down and was like, I can't tell him. I'm not going to be able to tell him because it encouraged me to actually get out. So when I'd get the podcast, I'd think, yep, I'll go out. I'll go for a walk, get me out and about, take my mind off things and change my perspective on my day, you know. So, not isolating yourself and knowing that
friends
and family there for you is so important.
Actually, you didn't isolate yourself. The first thing you said was your three beautiful children.
Yeah.
Well, that's your family, isn't it?
Mm.
And you have to make sure that you don't truly isolate yourself. This is a true story. My younger brother, who has had health issues all his life and will always have health issues, he came round and found me on the floor in my apartment where I'd been for about 3 days, unable to get up, you know, just unable because of my psychological situation to get up. And he found me like that. You can ask him. He's like, what the fuck are you doing, man? You want to look at this place, it's a mess. And for some reason, I thought, my brother Fola, who is, you know, challenged health-wise so much, is coming up and picking me up off the floor. It did something to me that I can't say. I thought, shit, I'm in a deep, deep, I need to get myself. I learned to play the guitar. You know, I played bass, but I didn't really play guitar. So I put myself into playing guitar. I changed my diet because I didn't know what was wrong with me, because you don't know how to get out of it when you're in there. But you just think, let me try everything. And it's like Descartes, actually, going back to, you know, my first love is philosophy, as you probably know. Descartes in the Meditations says, well, look, how can I rid myself of all the sort of, you know, poison of influences? How can I go back to first principles and start off and build a new philosophy without being prejudiced by what I previously knew? Well, when you get into a deep state, you're trying to get to the bottom of it, take out everything in your life and start again to see what is affecting you, you know, if
and
you can.
And what's important.
Yeah, well, if you can do that, but always hang on to your friendship. And I'm very privileged to hear that we were part of, you know, helping you get through that period. You should come on the World Football phone in and tell Tim Vickery, because he'll be, you know, so made up. And you know, I know that we are in a privileged position, and, you know, long
anytime,
may it continue.
Anytime. I'd love to come on anytime.
Yeah, okay.
I got Please so low don't. That I even considered buying green suede shoes.
no, not that low. I'm not gonna allow you to say that.
No.
How about next Monday then?
Yeah, for sure. I'll take
next
you
Monday. Next, it doesn't have to be next Monday, but I'm going to link you up money-wise with one of the producers, because being at the BBC, you don't want to tell them, oh, this is somebody I met, because they always suspect that a presenter has got some other agenda. You know, so the way I survived...
You're supposed to remain neutral on the BBC, isn't that right?
Well, you're not supposed to bring in somebody that happens to be a mate of yours or something like that, but it's not that you're not supposed to, but you do things formally. That's how you survive at the BBC. There are so many issues of compliance that you've got to fulfill with these things now.
But
so,
it's funny that, because even the fact of somebody calling a phone-in show, I think I submitted an email. Like, I used to have my own Brazilian shirt name for myself, and I used to call myself Mentolino because I was a bit...
Okay.
And that was what I was just designated shirt name. But
you can't but, have that.
The power of that conversation, you know, that someone can have with someone. Like, you can have one conversation with somebody and ask them, how are you going today? And not judge, just listen. It's unbelievable. And over the last few years, I've really learned that. And I always try to talk to people and ask how they're going and how things are. But yeah, just the power of that one conversation can change anyone's day, regardless of who we are, how much we earn, you know, what position we are in, what title we're in. It doesn't make a difference. At the end of the day, it's a powerful beast.
You know that Sean Wheelock won't be happy with you having your own Brazilian shirt name. So yes. We're going to have to take that off you. We're going to have to take that off you. No.
Gladly.
I'm going to mention that on air, and we'll take it off you officially and hopefully award you with a proper one.
Well, I should let you go, Cotton, but thanks again for your time.
Absolute pleasure, Frank.
We'll have to get you back on to actually touch on more football, but I'm glad we got a little bit deep and philosophical. It's much appreciated, and keep up the fantastic work.
Absolute pleasure, Frank. Anytime. Let's do it again.
Okay, take care.
Thank you. Yeah, all the best, mate. Bye-bye.
That was a great conversation with Dotton Adebayo. I'm really happy I got the opportunity to speak with him, and I felt like we barely scratched the surface and we could have kept talking for hours there. So hopefully we'll have him back on at a later date. Thanks everyone for listening to the podcast. The reception has been really overwhelmingly positive of late, so it's much appreciated. We've got some really great conversations due to be released across the next few weeks, so stay tuned for that. So thanks again. Don't forget to rate, review, and share the podcast where you can. It's all much appreciated. Take care, be kind, be awesome, and enjoy your culture.